From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the Scottish Literary Renaissance. We'll hear from three prominent writers who have given a voice to Scotland's working class while at the same time ruffling the feathers of Britain's literary establishment. James Kelman won the prestigious Booker Prize for a novel that made literary use of obscenities. Irvin Welsh has gathered a cult audience for his writing about drug addiction. His novel Trainspotting was recently adapted into a hit movie. And Scotland's newest literary star, Duncan MacLean, is making his American debut with his novel Bunker Man. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Bob Wills, who helped to define the sound of Western swing. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Friends and associates of Oklahoma City bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh are taking the stand today in a federal courthouse in Denver. Government prosecutors say McVeigh tried to recruit others to help carry out the 1995 bombing at the Murrah Federal Building, in which 168 people died. NPR's Mark Roberts reports from Denver.
Prosecutors will say McVeigh met a man named Greg Pfaff at gun shows. They charge McVeigh asked Pfaff to help him get detonation cord to use in the truck bomb. Another government witness is David Darlek, a man who grew up with McVeigh. Darlek will say McVeigh phoned him to try to get racing fuel, another bomb component. In his opening statements, lead prosecutor Joe Hartzler told the jury McVeigh didn't reveal why he wanted the racing fuel, but Darlek will come in and explain. Glenn Tipton may also testify today. Tipton works for a Kansas company called VP Racing Fuels. Tipton has already testified in a pretrial hearing that a man who called himself John approached him at a drag race and asked how to buy a racing fuel called nitromethane and anhydrous hydrazine, rocket fuel. Tipton says he's 90% sure John was Timothy McVeigh. I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
People who live near the Red River in North Dakota and Minnesota are beginning to deal with flood cleanup issues. 10% of the homes in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and East Grand Forks, Minnesota, are lost. The Red Cross says that number could jump to 20% when damage assessments are in. People returning home are finding that their houses are filled with mud and garbage. Zairean President Mobutu Sese Seko has put off his trip to Gabon for a meeting with rebel leader Laurent Kabila. Scheduled peace talks between them have been delayed one day until Saturday, but the South African government still says the talks will go on tomorrow. The meeting was announced after 2 days of tough diplomacy by United Nations envoy Bill Richardson. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Kinshasa.
President Mobutu Sese Seko officially agreed to the talks after weeks of resisting, attempting to put off what seems the inevitable outcome of such a summit, a plan for Mobutu's departure from power. The 66-year-old is Africa's longest-serving ruler, and anger at his corrupt regime has fueled a 7-month rebellion that now controls more than half the nation. The forces of rebel leader Laurent Kabila are poised to take the capital, Kinshasa, within weeks, if not days. Yesterday, U.S. envoy Richardson could only say he hopes the rebels will declare a ceasefire, and he admitted the prospects of a political agreement are dicey. Mobutu and Kabila have said they'll meet on a South African Navy vessel, with the talks taking place in international waters. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Kinshasa.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is off 32 points at 6,976. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed. The Dow Industrials are lower, but the NASDAQ Composite Index is up more than 9 points. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market is debating the outlook for interest rates in today's session. This morning's reports on manufacturing and construction were stronger than expected and argue for higher rates. But that's being met with a hope for a balanced budget agreement, which could mean that rates will fall. Semiconductor stocks are higher on the perception that prices for memory chips have stabilized and will move higher after a long period of steady declines. On the other hand, airline stocks are lower after Merrill Lynch raised concern about narrowing revenue margins for UAL Corp., the parent of United Airlines. I'm Doug Krisner.
the government has issued a report on Americans' personal income and spending. The Commerce Department says personal incomes were up 0.6% in March, while spending rose 0.5%. Both figures are slightly higher than expected and show that economic activity in March was strong. Consumer spending was what boosted the country's economic growth rate during the first 3 months of the year. The government is to report tomorrow on the unemployment rate for April, indicating the status of job growth last month. The Mississippi Attorney General is briefing lawmakers on Capitol Hill today on settlement talks between some 24 states and tobacco companies. Attorney General Michael Moore says any agreement will be so big and so complicated it will need federal legislation to implement it. He says if Congress agrees, there could be a radical change in the way tobacco companies do business. Again, on Wall Street, the Dow was down 32 points at 69.76. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, in for Terry Gross. Last summer, the Scottish movie Trainspotting opened and sparked immediate controversy. It was a high-energy ride filled with violence, drugs, and humor that showed the squalid life of Scottish slackers. The author of Trainspotting, Irvin Welsh, is just one of a new generation of young Scots who write with a wild energy drawn from the music, drugs, and slang of the youth culture they inhabit. My guests today are three of Scotland's most adventurous writers. Irvin Welsh is best known for Trainspotting, but has also written several other books, including The Acid House, which is also being made into a movie. Duncan MacLean is making his American debut with the new book Bunker Man. His next book will be a nonfiction account of his musical idol, Texas swing legend Bob Wills. And James Kelman, who won Britain's most esteemed literary award, the Booker Prize, in 1994 for his novel How Late It Was, How Late. This scandalized much of British society, and critics called his obscenity-drenched book, which is written almost entirely in dialect, unreadable and a piece of crap. Kelman's latest is a collection of short stories called Busted Scotch. We'll start with a reading by Duncan MacLean.
The book's called Bunker Man, and it's set in a small town on the east coast of Scotland. The central character is a janitor at the school there, and the other central character is his alter ego, who's a kind of mysterious figure, mysterious to Rob the janitor, although, of course, not mysterious to himself. And the book follows the course of Rob the Janny coming to know more about this alter ego, this bunker man. Here a scene from towards the end of the book where they've become quite chummy. They're in the janitor's office at the school at midnight, and Rob has given them something to eat. Rob sliced bread, spread it with marge, then chopped up a couple onions and made sandwiches. He handed one to Bunker Man and took a bite out of his own. Bunker Man wasn't eating. "Do we need to get a bit of cheese in this?" he said after a while. "Cheese and onion, that's a proper flavour. Onion by itself, isn't it?" "Rubbish," said Rob, chewing. "Bollocks. Cheese is just fat, solid orange animal fat. Who wants a slab of that in their gob? Not me. But onions are good for you, good for the blood. It's a well-known fact." "Is that right?" "Aye. Onions put zing in your blood. They're famous for it. I'm always eating them. Onion rings, scurly, French onion soup with croutons, chicken doppies in the Indian. And look at my blood, it's louping in my veins." "Is it?" "God, aye. Tuck in." Bunker Man lifted the top slice of bread and peered inside. "Are you sure?" Rob sighed. "Okay," he said. "Seeing as it's your feast, you can have some cheese. But I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. Or a bunker pole, come to that." Bunker Man gazed at him for a second, then shut the sandwich and took a huge bite. "You can have cheese," said Rob. Bunker Man shook his head, said something through a full mouth. "It's no bother," said Rob, looking around for the Scottish cheddar. "What did you say?" Bunker Man took a few big chews, then mumbled through half a mouthful. "It's no bad." He swallowed again. "Zing," he said. "Aye, that's another thing," said Rob. "Onions are meant to make you greet, right? But did you see my tears in my eyes just then? No way, because I eat so much of the buggers, I'm immune. I never greet anymore. Onions are like a jag against greeting." "That's good," said Bunker Man. "That's what I need." "I'll tell you something else," said Rob, finishing his sandwich. "I saw a hypnotist once. I was on holiday in Spain and I saw this guy in an English pub. He gave a girl an onion, then he hypnotised her and told her it was an apple.
and she ate the whole damn thing, saying how sweet it was. Everybody was killing themselves.
Suicide?
Eh? No, laughing a lot. That's what killing yourself means, laughing a lot.
Right, said Bunker Man.
But the point is, eating an onion's nothing to me. I just went, so, and walked out the f***ing place. I'd rather eat an onion than an apple any time.
Bunker Man looked around at the food spread between them, then reached forward and picked up the bag of Mac Reds.
All right, he said. You take one of these, Johnny Man, then I'll hypnotise you and convince you it's an onion.
Rob looked at him, then at the apples, then at Bunker Man again. Then he burst out laughing. He threw his head back and roared. After half a minute, it turned into a squeaky chuckle, and he gasped for breath and was back into a big hooting laugh. He waved his hands about in front of him, helpless, then brought them up to wipe away the tears that had sprung from his eyes.
And that's Duncan McLean reading from his new novel, and it's called Bunker Man. I know you worked as a janitor for a while. Do I identify with Rob in this story?
I worked as a janitor in a village hall, which is kind of used occasionally for dances and playgroups and karate clubs and stuff like that. The janitor in this book is works in a school, which the reason I made him a janitor was I like stories about people working, you know, there don't seem to be enough of them ever. And I wanted to make the main character in this book do a bit of work now and then, and janitorial work was a kind of work that I knew about. When I started the book, I didn't know the guy was going to turn out quite so nasty, otherwise I might have made him work at some other job, like a radio interviewer or something, you know, because people keep asking me if it's autobiographical.
Well, each of you uses language in a really very powerful way, as a way to develop characters through the words that they speak. And this I'm going to put to you, or at least begin with you, James Kelman. Is there something distinctive about Scottish writing and Scottish writers to develop characters so strongly through dialogue and through just literally the words that they speak?
Well, I suppose without the language, the people don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem, if you look at English literature or what you could call mainstream English literature, the sorts of stuff that gets taught in universities and through the education systems, what you find is that the people that would be the subject material of our work simply don't exist at all. What you get is like about 85% of the English-speaking population don't exist in literature because the language in which they could come to life for whatever reason has been either repressed, suppressed or oppressed over the last 100 or so years. So the way that we are using language, as far as I can see, and the way that other writers are using it, not only in Scotland but also in, for example, the Caribbean, parts of Africa and other parts of the former English Empire are beginning to kind of use a reclaim language.
Well, I know there's this whole controversy about whether Scottish is a language, whether it's a dialect. It reminds me to some degree of the controversy in this country about what American English is and what Black English is. And I want to throw this back to you, James Kelman, because I know this is something that you've really wrestled with and have a lot of opinions on and passion about.
Well, I think if you begin by looking even, just say, look up the word dialect in a dictionary. And the word dialect, or the term dialect, is always the ways in which we define it are inferior. They always relate it to a kind of given language. The language is the true way to speak and to write, so that dialect becomes an inferior form of that, some kind of offshoot that is always inferior relative to it. So if you kind of take by extension the people that use that form of, in quotes, language, which is the dialect, both them and their culture both become inferior relative again to that norm, the standard one. And what's missed in these kind of studies is that the ways in which African-American people in different parts of the US would use English and the ways that, for example, different people in Scotland would use it. I mean, the three of us use English in very different ways, although it's a very small country. You have these different ways of using English. And if you were to examine these different ways in which we're using it, you'll find that the rhythms in which we use language actually come from languages that are not English.
Hmm.
So in a sense, to describe it as a dialect is just a nonsense. It's obviously it's a language and has all the richness of any language.
Our guests today are Irvin Welsh, author of Trainspotting, James Kelman, who won the Booker Prize for How Late It Was, How Late, and Duncan MacLean, who's making his U.S. debut with Bunker Man. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Scottish writers Duncan MacLean, Irvin Welsh, and James Kelman. Well, let me turn to you, Irvin Welsh, and have you read a story. This is, or at least the beginning of a story. It's called Plastic Surgery, and it's from a book of yours called The Acid House.
Yeah, this is an extended novella called The Smart Cunt from The Acid House, and this is a section called Plastic Surgery. I'm sitting, holding my face together in my hands, or that's how it seems. I'm aware of people around me, their outraged gasps indicating that it's bad. I know that. The blood falls through my fingers and hits the wooden pub floor in steady, even drops. Hobo and I were close mates once, a few years ago now. He didn't like me pulling him around, begging him to get me sorted out. Get out of my face, Bri! I'm warning you, man! I was given plenty of warning. I never took Hobo seriously enough. I always thought he was a bit of a poser, him hanging about with Ain Utters. By keeping that company, though, you can become an utter yourself. He's far more a man of substance than I thought. Being proved wrong hurts almost as much as my face. My cells, my f***ing sick, junk-deprived cells hurt the most. I hit the smack heavily this weekend. Things were getting a bit much. I needed to blot it all out. Everything. It took one sweeping motion off the glass. One motion, and here I'm holding my face together, and Hobo's shouting defensively about junkies f***ing hassling him and extracting himself from the bar as the collective wrath develops.
And that's Irvin Welsh reading from his book called The Acid House. It's a story called Plastic Surgery. That's a very powerful story, and you have a way of getting into people's unconscious mind, whether it's through their own drug addiction or whether they're, as this person is, dealing with having to have some kind of plastic surgery. Is that a world you know?
I don't know. It's difficult to say. You don't really kind of you don't really think of the world you're in and kind of abstract it in that sense to say whether it's a world you know or not. I mean, it's like kind of shopping and habitat and all that's a world I know as well, you know. So I think you can know all different kinds of worlds. I don't like the idea of, you know, something like that kind of being seen as this somehow another world. You mm-hmm. know, it's just one world and it's all, everything goes on in that world.
Well, I also notice in your writing, and this has been noticed before, is that you do use a fair amount of obscenities, and I know that this is the way that people talk, but I wonder, as you write it, whether you see obscenities as a form of punctuation and or as a way of just making this realism really dance on the page. Maybe I can throw that to you, Irvin Welsh, but I'd be interested in the other two of you as well.
Yeah, I don't think I really do use any obscenities or very many, and I don't think it's punctuation either. I think it's like you just acknowledge that language is fluid and it changes. So, it can mean so many different things. It doesn't mean... It can be a term of endearment, it can be a term of abuse, it can be a descriptive term. So you acknowledge the fluidity of language, and it's like that language might start off as, say, pejorative and sexist or whatever, or about kind of control, but once it's been appropriated by that oppressed group and age, and it has a kind of myriad of different meanings, so you have to accept that as it is, and not getting to the whole censorship thing.
Well, what I find interesting, because I think it's true with most language or most words, if you use them over and over and over again, they either lose their power or they lose their meaning. And I know, James Kelman, when you got the Booker Prize for how late it was, how late some critic or journalist spent, I don't know how many hours counting up, how many times the F word appeared in that book, and I think they got to something like 4,000. Do you find with words like the F word and other obscenities that they really do retain their power and that they have multiple meanings that can be used in very expressive ways?
Yeah, I mean, I always wondered how many ands were in the book. I wondered if any journalists had counted an and. The whole ways in which we kind of discuss the use of so-called obscenities in relation to literature was kind of devalued as a way of talking about language about 70 years ago. I mean, we've had two... Chomsky's been responsible for two revolutions in the way we look at language alone, you know, and there's these other people who have been working in language for the last... around 70 years, and why are we still talking about language in this way as though somehow there is the word, you know? Maybe it's some kind of religious thing, the word was handed down and all that. But as far as the world science goes, evolution, I mean, the word begins from sound.
Mm-hmm.
The word wasn't handed down on a plate, you know? And once we can grasp that point, there is no fixed meaning. When you say that words lose their meaning, it's not that. You've already kind of infused that word with a precise meaning. But for any, I mean, language doesn't exist until it's used, and once people are using it, it becomes a function of how they use it, whether or not we can describe it as obscene. You know, as Urban said, the so-called obscenities can be used to express beauty as one of the most common ways of using these so-called obscenities.
Duncan MacLean, how do you grapple with language and the kinds of words that you use?
I don't think I do grapple, and it's kind of, I noticed you saying that Jim wrestled with such issues earlier on, and the idea of us all sitting at our desks, you know, kind of, oh, that language, it's got me, half Nelson. You know, the problem, all your questions, have been asking us to kind of look at the language we use, the words we use, what we write from the outside, as if we kind of sit down and say to ourselves, well, will I use obscenities today or will I not? Will I write in a dialect today or will I write in a language? As if we can kind of sit apart from it and decide what we're going to do. But for me at least, and I think the others as well, it's just that's just not a kind of thinking that comes into your head at all. You sit down and you try and tell a story. You use the language that is in your head or in your mouth. And that language is the language that, you know, that you grew up speaking, or that your neighbours speak, or your friends speak, or your family speak. And you don't kind of attach all these separate little labels to it and make little value judgments about this bit of it or any other bit of it. You just think, this is the language that I use, and this is the story I'm going to tell with the language that I use.
There is a sense, I think, through the stories and through interviews as well, is that many people in Scotland feel that they have been marginalized by England. And I wonder if you even look at the school system, whether there's a way that literature and English and languages are taught that makes Scottish people feel as if they're less than, and I wonder if I can put that to you, Duncan MacLean.
This certainly my experience, and I should think everybody in Scotland probably still, certainly until very recently, was that what we were taught, the first thing we went to school at the age of 5 or 6 was that the language that we were speaking was somehow inferior. And had to be got rid of. I remember very, very clearly being told by a teacher when I was 5 or 6 that certain words I was using did not exist.
Such as?
She didn't even... there was a word, breeks, which is what I would have said naturally for what in England would be trousers, and I would still more or less breeks.
I remember very, very clearly the teacher saying to me, there's no such word as breeks. So it wasn't even that you were told it was bad or inappropriate or wrong or something. It was that what you'd been speaking for, what you'd been brought up speaking was something that did not exist. And that's very widespread experience, and that little bit there is kind of symptomatic of a lot of being educated
still
in Scotland.
Still the same. You can't, for example, kids in school just now are not allowed to use the word I in the classroom. They have to use the word yes. They can't use I. So the kids just now in Scotland are still punished. But it's not only an issue for Scottish children, although it is the case there, but it also happens in other parts of the United Kingdom, you know. So I'm sure Yorkshire kids are not allowed to use ye instead of you, or, you know, these kind of things.
Let me just jump in here only because I'm keeping an eye on the clock, and there's still lots that I'd like to talk to you about, including a little bit about each of your growing up and that kind of a thing. So let me just shift gears here slightly. And if I can begin with you, James Kelman, what kind of a family did you grow up in, and where did you grow up in Scotland?
I grew up in Glasgow, and just a kind of ordinary sort of family, really, from an ordinary Glasgow experience, which was a post-Second World War housing scheme.
Mm-hmm. Like a housing project?
There was about 45,000 people lived in the housing scheme in which I was brought up in, which was called Drumchapel in Glasgow. And these were kind of treated like townships, in the way that Soweto is a township, that the people weren't really... It became an economic kind of problem in order to travel into the centre of the city. There were no resources, no amenities, that kind of place. There's many of these in the States.
Yeah.
That was a sort of which was an ordinary background, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You began to write it around the age of 21 or so. What inspired you?
Well, I was unemployed. and I was finding at that time that the only times I could actually contemplate writing. I thought about writing for quite a while. Or rather, I didn't think about it in any reflective way. I just sort of took it for granted that one of these days I would begin writing. and I wasn't kind of... I was single at the time. So life could be exciting if you had money. So at a stage when I was without money, I began to write.
Scottish writers James Kelman, Irvin Welsh, and Duncan MacLean will be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with three writers driving the Scottish literary renaissance, Irvin Welsh, James Kelman, and Duncan MacLean. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Bob Wills, who helped to define the Western swing sound. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's continue our conversation with Scottish writers James Kelman, Irvin Welsh, and Duncan MacLean. Duncan MacLean's latest novel is called Bunker Man. He's working on a book about his travels through Texas in search of his musical hero, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. James Kelman won the Booker Prize in 1994 for his novel How Late It Was, How Late. His newest book is a collection of short stories called Busted Scotch. Irvin Welsh made a name for himself with the publication of his novel Trainspotting, which was made into a movie last year. His latest book is called Ecstasy. To you, Irvin Welsh, tell us a little bit about the family you grew up in.
Oh, landed gentry. It's quite similar to Jim's, really. It's a similar experience, like, kind of born in Leith, which is, like, sort of old port of Edinburgh, which was, like, sort of half-demolished in the 60s, and we all moved out to Muirhouse, which was, like... maybe a bit of a village compared to Drumthrapple. It was only about 30,000 instead of 45,000 mm-hmm. there. But it still didn't have a public toilet or a pub until much later on. Huh. So it was like, it was basically that kind of, very kind of archetypal sort of central Scotland sort of background, really. And that was basically me, yeah.
Well, you wrote Trainspotting, your first novel, on a bus ride between New York City and Los Angeles. Is that right?
Well, I wrote the original notes that became Trainspotting on that, just because that was the first writing I'd ever done, because it was I was so bored on this bus journey. It was such a, you know, you couldn't really see anything. And so I just started writing, filling in these wee notebooks and making up kind of wee stories to amuse myself, basically, for that long sort of trek. And I put them away for years and years and never thought about them until I just decided to kind of sort of write them up, you know.
And when you wrote Trainspotting, which of course has been made into a film which came out last year in the States, the reaction was interesting, because on the one hand, reading the book, you certainly don't judge people who use drugs and you certainly don't glorify them. But I think many critics use that as a way of saying, because you don't condemn drug use and drug users, that it was a novel or a story that glorified drugs. What was your reaction to that?
I think that's just nonsense. I mean, it's like, I think that you have to start off from the, if you're writing about things and you're writing about life, you can't really sort of selectively say what is and what isn't in the culture. Things that are in the culture are in the culture because they're there. I mean, it's like if somebody wrote a book, and you've seen so many tiresome books about people saying, oh, drugs are horrible, drugs are evil, drugs destroy and drugs kill, they're boring. If somebody else wrote a book saying, oh, drugs are great, this is brilliant, this is fantastic, drugs, 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 wow, let's have some more, boring, tedious, you know what I mean? Because both of these books are starting off from some kind of agenda, you know? What you're doing is that you're writing about, you're just writing about what you see and what's there, the characters, the situations, what people get up to, and without necessarily, you know, but what's why? I mean, if you write a book about horses, you don't have to say that horses are brilliant or horses are crap, you know, or if you write a book about, I don't know, so, you know, it's like anything else that, what's the point? It's nothing to do, it's nothing to do with it. I mean, your values should have nothing to do with it.
Were you ready for the kind of publicity that came from the novel, then the play, then the movie?
Not really, no. It was a wee bit freaky at the time, but I was fortunate that I managed to escape most of it, because I was living in Amsterdam, and when it was like, you know, when the book just started to take off in Scotland, I was in Amsterdam in Holland, and then when it took off in the States, I was over there. And when I moved over to London, it had died down a little bit, but it was kicking off in Europe and in Amsterdam and at the time. So I kind of missed sort of being right at the kind of heart of the storm, which was good, because it wouldn't have been a particularly comfortable place to be.
With the kind of publicity, I think it's still being generated about Trainspotting and some of the controversies about the story. What kind of effect has it had on you as a writer? I know you've written several other books since that time, but has it made it easier or harder to write?
It's made it a lot easier in a lot of ways, because now it's put me in a kind of sort of financial sort of league and a kind of sort of sales profile that it means that you don't really have to sort of worry about where the next bit of money's coming from, which is quite sort of unusual and quite a luxurious position for a writer to be in. So that's happened with my first book, really. So it's quite a kind of sort of it's quite a sort of good thing for me. There's always this kind of idea that you should follow and write a kind of Trainspotting 2 and all that. So there's a pressure to do that, which is maybe quite a negative thing. And, I'm quite fortunate that the second book that I've done, The Acid House, is getting made into a film just now. It's been filmed in Scotland, so I think that's going to be quite a big film and quite a sort of highly sort of rated film. So what I think it will do is it will generalise it a bit more rather than me being seen as a kind of the Trainspotting guy. You know, it'll make it sort of a bit more kind of sort of give the kind of work a bit more of a balance, and the rights have gone for the third book to be filmed as well. So I think these things will give it a kind of a more sort of balanced profile. I mean, Trainspotting's it was a very, very good book to have as a first book, but it is the kind of book that does cast a shadow over you, and I'm glad that my other stuff's being filmed and translated into theatre as well, so that it kind of it pushes that into the light a bit.
Will your next book have drug use in it?
I don't know. It might have horses in it, but I'm not really sure, because it's you can't really say in advance. You can't really say I'll have loads of drug use in my next book, although there probably will be. You know, there's no sort of kind of getting away from it. I mean, the reason I like writing about drugs is because, apart from the fact that just about everybody that I know takes loads of drugs, it gives you a way into sort of I like kind of extremity in writing, and it gives you a way into different sort of states of consciousness. It gives you a way into different sort of states of behaviour.
I'm speaking with Irvin Welsh, author of Trainspotting, James Kelman, who won the Booker Prize for How Late It Was, How Late, and Duncan MacLean, who's making his U.S. debut with Bunkerman. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our conversation with Scottish writers Duncan MacLean, Irvin Welsh, and James Kelman. Let me turn now to you, Duncan MacLean, and tell us a little bit about the family you grew up in.
Different from Jim and Irvin, I grew up very much in the country, in Aberdeenshire in the northeast of Scotland, in a community of about 45 people, I suppose, as opposed to 45,000. So that probably shaped me quite a lot.
How so, do you think?
Well, it was a pretty homogenous place. There weren't really big class distinctions between different folk. You knew everybody personally. That was one reason why. And if somebody had more money than somebody else, that was down to, you know, that individual. Well, that's how it seemed when I was growing up anyway. So it was quite a big shock to me when I went to the city for the first time when I was 18, when I went to university in Edinburgh, because that was that completely different world for me, going to live in a city. It was quite a shock to my system.
You were part of a comedy troupe that toured Scotland called the Mary Mac Fun Show.
That's how I got started in writing, because I was obsessed with music when I was a kid, and I still am to an extent. And for years I had this dream about being a musician, and the Mary Macs were a kind of comedy musical group, and we played all sorts of venues, from big theatres, community centres, youth clubs, unemployed worker centres. We bussed on the streets, we did television, radio. We did that part-time for a couple of years, and more or less full-time for a couple of years after that. And this is really how I got into writing songs first of all, and then kind of patter for between the songs, which gradually evolved into sketches, which then evolved into full-length plays.
You like performing?
Yeah, I do like performing, but I
I got fed up of the lifestyle that goes with a performing lifestyle. Like, I found it's a bit like being on this tour, actually. You know, it's kind of very artificial life when you're a performer, or the kind of music that I was doing, because you would start work at like 10 o'clock at night, and it's like being in a permanent night shift. You wouldn't get to see any daylight, and you wouldn't get to see any of your friends or anything like that, because you wouldn't get up until 3 in the afternoon or something like that, and then you'd go to bed at 6 in the morning because you were doing a late night gig somewhere. And it drove me a bit mad after a while. I think I had to get out of it. And, you know, there's so much. To begin with, it was more the performing, but then I got more and more into the writing side of it, and I wanted to concentrate on the writing rather than having to put on a show every night. Ultimately, I found that a pain in the neck. Of course, I keep going back to it and trying it. So, although I mostly do fiction these days, every 6 months or so, I seem to get tangled up in some theatre project or other, and, you know, with high hopes, usually regretting it profoundly after about 5 minutes.
Well, I know that you are a great big fan of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. How did you first hear this group?
When I was growing up in Scotland, you know, country music was the big thing where I was living, in the rural parts, and I think it's probably the same in a lot of bits of Scotland. I heard a lot of that when I was a kid, Johnny Cash and Hank Williams. Yeah. I also heard an awful lot of traditional Scottish music. The northeast of Scotland's a kind of hotbed of bothy ballads and folk songs and so on. But of course, being that age, I was also very into the kind of pop music of the time. So there was all these different kinds of music I was into, and I listened to all of them for years, and quite by chance I came across a record in a junk shop in Edinburgh nearly 10 years ago now, of this guy called Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. I thought that was the stupidest name for a band I'd ever had in my life. It looked vaguely countryish, which I quite liked, so yeah. The guy had a Stetson on, you know. So I bought it, listened to it, and was blown away. Because Bob Wills played all those types of music. He played traditional fiddling tunes, and he played jazzy stuff, he played blues, he played country songs. Every kind of music I'd ever liked seemed to be being played simultaneously by this big band he had. And just from that very first record, I've been hooked, you know. And what started as an interest in that one record has led me to this incredible situation where I found myself back in Texas for the third time in 2 years, researching ever more esoteric regions of the music.
I get any Bob Wills through Waylon James, just that song, When You're Down in Texas.
Go on, Jim.
Bob Wills, how did you get into Bob Wills?
Bob Wills is still the king.
I got into Bob. I was talking about Bob Mills, the chat show host in Britain. Like, you know. I didn't get into him. They found he was in a pornography, a gay porn movie recently. Like,
Bob Wills was in a gay porn movie.
Wow. Bob Mills.
Thank God.
Let me jump in here. Well, obviously, for you, Duncan MacLean, music has been an important part of, I assume, even your writing. And I wonder back to you, James Kelman, whether there are certain kinds of music that you found important to being a novelist, whether even if you write, you need to have music on just to hear all those rhythms at work.
You know, just before that, music has been really important to me in writing that. I became aware of that recently, or rather I worked it out, the explosion that was going on amongst the white working class youth in Britain that had come from the blues and country music. That kind of empowerment was very influential on me. Really, I think the influence that was so responsible for all these great bands of the early and mid-60s in Britain, the great R&B bands, these are the influences that were on me. It was just like you have the right to create art. What is your art? Is it music? Is it literature? What is it? Go ahead and do it.
And put it all together.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like... I mean, music's been everything to me in terms of what I've done. I think if it hadn't been for the sort of the whole Acid House explosion in 1988, I would never have thought about writing seriously. That was the kind of thing that kind of opened me up to wanting to express myself in different ways. And it's like kind of what I try and do with the books is just really kind of sort of capture that kind of excitement of the best sort of house music, just kind of firing in and sort of turning it over and having the narrator, like the DJ, is not particularly an important figure, just having the characters speaking for themselves and getting into the heart of it.
What's it like for you all to be touring together, so to speak, as you make your way around the United States? You feel like a rock band or something?
Yeah, we feel like Brotherhood of Man.
Yeah, the Scottish Spice Girls, the Spice Boys.
This is our very first interview. I haven't seen Irvin and Jim until about half an hour ago.
Oh, is that right?
Because we all kind of travelled here separately because we had different commitments in different places. So I'm still quite enjoying it at the moment, but I expect it'll be downhill from now on.
Just the honeymoon period between us now. You see.
So we got you on the upswing then. Well, we are out of time, and I want to thank all three of you for joining us today on Fresh Air. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Duncan MacLean's novel is called Bunker Man. James Kelman's book is a collection of short stories called Busted Scotch. And Irvin Welsh's latest short story collection is called Ecstasy. Duncan MacLean just told us about his affection for Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. Coming up, Ed Ward has a profile. This is Fresh Air. Bob Wills may not have invented Western swing, the music to which his name is inextricably linked, but he certainly perfected it. During the 30 years that he fronted his band, the Texas Playboys, he developed a fusion of American music that is uncannily like the fusion Elvis Presley would accomplish 20 years later.
Bob Wills, as Bob Wills was named at birth, was a son of the hard West Texas farmland, descended from two generations of champion fiddlers. But fiddling, back in 1905 when Wills was born, didn't pay any bills, so he grew up picking cotton alongside black sharecroppers. When he declared in his theme song, Take Me Back to Tulsa, that darky raised the cotton, white man gets the money, it wasn't PC, but it was based on hard-won knowledge. In 1925, he'd had enough of barbering and farming in the hamlet of Turkey, Texas, so he packed off for Fort Worth, where he hooked up with the Medicine Show, and eventually with guitarist Herman Arnspiger and singer Milton Brown. The band they formed turned first into the Light Crust Doughboys, then into Milton Brown's Brownies, and in 1933, when Bob left with singer Tommy Duncan, into the Texas Playboys.
There was a time when I thought of no other. And we sing our own love's refrain. Our hearts beat as one as we had our fun, but time changes everything. When you left me, my poor heart was broken. Our romance seemed all in vain. The dark clouds are gone and there's blue skies again, 'cause time changes everything.
Playboys were nothing if not versatile. One minute they'd be playing a pop-style song with Duncan crooning his heart out, and the next they'd metamorphose into a big band with horns. Bob would step out with his fiddle, and another dimension would be added.
Where's that gal, the red dress on some folks called a Dinah? My heart away from me, way down Louisiana. Take me back to Tulsa, I'm too young to marry. Take me back to Tulsa, I'm too young to marry.
Oh, here comes Mr. Strickland now. All right.
Cigar clamped in his jaws, Bob would interject one of his characteristic hollers as each member soloed. And, most importantly, the band could swing.
Oh, have you seen Miss Molly? Her cheeks are rosy red. Her lips are soft as satin, and they taste like gingerbread.
Don't tell me.
Oh, me, oh, my Miss Molly, I'm in love with you. Oh, me, oh, my Miss Molly, won't you say you love me too?
With fiddlers like Jesse Ashlock and, on this recording, Joe Holly, Wills always made sure he had soloists who could negotiate trickier pyrotechnics than he himself was capable of. Wills was up to the minute. When we'd pull into a big city, as pianist Al Strickland told me, he'd order up a cab and head out to the black section of town to see if Count Basie had any new records out, and he'd bring them back and study them. He was also up on technology. The Playboys featured one of the first electric guitarists in Eldon Shamblin, and Leon McAuliffe put the electric steel guitar on the map.
Oh, everybody dance now. I'm swinging, Mr. Leon, swinging.
Paid off. The band's San Antonio Rose was a huge hit, and Wills, who wrote it, made plenty off of Bing Crosby's cover version, too.
Deep within my heart lies a melody, a song of old San Antonio, where in dreams I live with the memory beneath the stars all alone. It was there I found the Alamo, enchantment strange as the blue up above, a moonlit path that only she would know, still hears my broken song of love. Moon in all your splendor, no, only my heart, call back my rose, rose of San Antonio, lips so sweet and tender, like petals falling apart. Speak once again of my love, my own.
But time does change everything. World War II devastated the Texas Playboys. Tommy Duncan enlisted right after Pearl Harbor, Al Strickland got a defense job, and both Leon McAuliffe and Eldon Shamblin joined up soon afterwards. Bob himself spent a few unpleasant months in the Army in 1943, and after he and Duncan mustered out, they relocated to California, lured by the movies and radio work. The horns were gone, but the new steel player, Noel Boggs, made up for that, and the band still swung like crazy. There was also frustration. The band made Western movies, but they weren't much good. Bob began drinking, which, combined with his new Wills Point Ballroom in Sacramento, which he was supposed to perform often, led to problems with the band. In 1948, Wills fired Tommy Duncan and thereby shot himself in the foot. Plus, fashions in country music were changing, and although Bob never considered himself a country performer, the record industry did. Musicians left the band, his record stopped selling, and by the time he had his first heart attack in 1962, Bob Wills had been all but forgotten. Forgotten by the public, that is. A small swing revival in California began in 1970, when Merle Haggard recorded a Bob Wills tribute album using several ex-Playboys, and a band called Asleep at the Wheel started performing skillful Western swing in bars near San Francisco. In 1973, Haggard reunited the Playboys for an album with the ailing Wills, who shouted his approval on several tracks. But the strain was too much. He suffered a stroke and remained in a coma for almost 2 years. The album came out with a sad title, For the Last Time. The swing revival grew, though, and today Western swing is in the hands of a new generation, who often record with the old masters. Bob Wills is gone, but he's not forgotten.
Ed Ward writes about music from Berlin. Fresh Air's engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Al Banks, and Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
You ought to see my blue-eyed Sally. She lives away down on Shinbone Alley. The number on the gate, the number on the door, and the next house over is a grocery store. Stay all night, stay a little longer. Dance all night, dance a little longer. Pull off your coat, throw it in the corner. Don't see why you don't stay a little longer. Cause the bridge washed out at the bottom of the hill.
Right, Tommy.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember Chicago columnist Mike Royko, who died this week at the age of 64. His column was syndicated in more than 800 papers nationwide. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.